Merry Christmas from all of us here at For Faith and Family. To celebrate this festive season, we'd like to revisit a few of our favorite programs from 2008. So relax and enjoy as we hear some powerful messages from our guests this week. Also, be sure to tune in next Monday and Tuesday as we air a special Christmas program with Dr. Tom Eliff. He's going to tell us a compelling Christmas story he calls The Red Feather. Hello and welcome to another edition of For Faith and Family with Dr. Richard Land. I'm Harold Harper, and today we welcome to the program Dr. Arthur Brooks. He is a professor of public administration at Syracuse University. He's also written two books that we're going to be talking about today, Who Really Cares? And Gross National Happiness. Dr. Brooks has spent years researching how people's values affect their charitable giving and in turn how that affects their happiness. And we're glad to have him with us here today. Let's join Dr. Land as he welcomes our guest.
This is Richard Land, and we have a special guest with us today, Arthur Brooks. Dr. Brooks, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Richard. It's really an honor to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about who is Arthur Brooks.
It's a long journey to the kind of writing that I've been doing, but I'm a university professor. I'm an academic economist. And I've been doing academic research for a long time, just like most university professors, for the last 10 years. And a few years ago, it occurred to me that I was basically asking and answering the wrong questions. I would go out and I would talk to people in my research, and I would ask them things like, you know, how do you feel about the inheritance tax? And they would say, it didn't matter how much money they made, it didn't matter what income class or social class they were from, they said they overwhelmingly hated it. That I hate the inheritance tax. I think it's wrong. And I would say, well, if they didn't make much money, I'd say, well, it doesn't affect you. I mean, on the contrary, it's good for you because it takes money out of rich people's pockets and it, you know, only rich people's pockets, and it gives it to you. And they'd say, yeah, but that's not the point. The point is it's not fair. The point is I don't like it. The point is it makes me feel like I'm living in less of a free country to take people's resources that they gainfully and rightfully and honestly earn. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm asking the whole wrong set of questions as an economist. I'm just trying to measure money in people's lives. And people, they don't think about that. What gets them up in the morning, what animates them and makes them do what they do is whether things make them happy. I said, I need to write about the real values that people truly have, their values of charity, their values of fairness, and ultimately the happiness that underlies everything they do. And that's what's led me to the books that we're talking about today.
Now, talk to us about your faith journey, because my guess is from reading these books, you've been on a faith journey.
Well, you know, I think we're all on a faith journey, and how seriously we take it determines to a very large extent how successful we're going to be, of course. I mean, I grew up in a Christian family. I'm pleased to practice my Roman Catholic faith, but I have to say that it's gotten much deeper as I've looked at the facts. You know, as a trained economist, one of the things that we learn is that it's very tough to take things seriously in you unless you've got some evidence. You need data on things, and that's kind of how I see the world. I'm always looking for data that say either what I thought I knew was right or what I thought I knew was wrong. And one of the things that I've found over the past 10 years in particular that has deepened my own faith as a Christian is the fact that you just can't find biblical principles that are not backed up by the facts. It sounds ridiculous to say that you need, you know, data to back up the scriptures, that you need social science to back up the scriptures, but I have to say it's very reassuring that the laws of the universe, that the natural principles that guide our daily lives and everything that happens around us, these are not just things that are taught to us by our parents and grandparents and by our clergy. These are also things that we can discover through the science, what we think of as the science of man. If we're honest about looking at the facts and social sciences and the natural sciences, we come upon the beauty of the universe as manifest not just in our faith, but also in our science.
Well, it's apologetics. It's telling us that what God the designer designed and what God the designer has chosen to tell us is true. Turns out, son of a gun, when you try it, it's true.
That's right. And, you know, we are given these wonderful gifts of intellect. I frequently have found, as a Christian scholar, that people believe there's a tension between intellect and faith. And the reason they believe there's a tension between intellect and faith is because so many intellectuals don't have faith and they scorn faith. And so many people of deep, abiding religious faith have not actually developed as much as they could their intellectual side. But ultimately, when we can become entirely comfortable with this idea that learning and faith can sit side by side. They, generally speaking, they govern different parts of our lives. They govern a different set of questions in our lives. Mm-hmm. But there are these moments when they come together.
That's one of the things I love about these books. And I wrote a blog in Casting Stones in which I talk about the fact that that we ought to start calling Dr. Brooks Arthur the Myth Slayer, because you have slain these myths. And you say that you used to believe some of these myths. I want to quote to you from Who Really Cares. You say, "These are not the sorts of conclusions I ever thought I would reach when I started looking at charitable giving in graduate school 10 years ago. I have to admit that I probably would have hated what I have to say in this book." So you are that rarest of jewels, an open-minded academic intellectual.
Well, thank you. I have to say, though, that my mind being opened or closed, I just was crushed under the weight of the data. There was no escape. I mean, if I had dedicated myself to looking at what people say in surveys and taking them seriously, I just found that you can't hold on to certain beliefs about the way the world works in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. I mean, there's a very common view that that people of faith, for example, particularly conservative people of faith, they're stingy. They actually care less about the needy of the world, and those who care the most are the broadest minded sort of secular liberals that live not in the great hereafter, but in this world to relieve suffering. And I mean, that's a very common thing to believe, but when you look at the data, it's just not true. You find that people who believe that the government should not redistribute income are 12 times more likely to give more money each year than people who do believe the government should redistribute income. And furthermore, that people who attend a house of worship regularly are 25 percentage points more likely to give money to charity each year, and about the same percentage points more likely to give their time. And furthermore, they're even more likely to give their time and money to completely non-religious causes. So you get rid of all the religious stuff, the houses of worship and even the religious hospitals and schools, and they're still more likely to volunteer for their PTA or even give to environmental organizations. The fact of the matter is that the stereotypes about hard-hearted, evangelicals, religious folks, conservatives, those stereotypes just don't stand up to the facts.
Now, you talk in the beginning of the book about the observations about American charity between former President Carter and Alexis de Tocqueville. Share that with our listeners.
Well, President Carter has said consistently something that he is a quote from him from a 2004 speech, in which he told an audience that the problem with Americans is that we just don't care about the less fortunate of the world. That's the problem with Americans. That's a pretty grim view of the American character, but that's the way a lot of people see us, including a lot of people in our own American politics, that Americans are good, hard-headed, hard-working folks, but when it comes to the less fortunate around the world, they just don't care. Well, that's actually completely at variance with the facts. This is one of the first big myths that I actually try to wipe out because it's so clearly not true. Americans care privately with respect to the way that they give of their own resources, not that the government takes from them and gives, but rather the way that they give their own money and time. They give more than people from any other country. You find that the average American gives 3.5 times as much per capita as the average Frenchman, 7 times as much as the average German, and 14 times as much money per year as the average Italian. There simply is no comparison. What Jimmy Carter characterizes as the truth about the American character simply is false.
And de Tocqueville had it more right, didn't he?
Well, de Tocqueville believed that the characteristic of the American character was one in which, in a vast, ungovernable frontier, that we couldn't do things with government, that we had to band together to do things for ourselves. And one of the big secrets to American success was the fact that we take problems into our own hands and we try to solve them as private citizens. De Tocqueville recognized one of the great beauties and differences in American life compared to that in Europe was, as he said, you know, whereas in France you'll find a man of nobility, and in England you'll find a government official, in the United States you'll find an association of private citizens banding together to solve private problems. Now, we could do more, and my view is that the sky's the limit on how much we could serve each other. But to say that we don't somehow, simply because the government is not taking care of problems in many cases, like it would in Europe, is absolutely missing the point of how we've set up our country. What we need to do, of course, is to prove that the way that we do things is appropriate and correct, and the way that we can prove that is by doing even more of it and celebrating our private charity.
You know, when I was I was introduced to the sublime and the ridiculous of a Princeton education in the late 1960s, my first week at Princeton. We had to go in for freshman orientation week a week before all the other students arrived in the fall of 1965. I showed up at the Princeton campus having been given a summer reading assignment to read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. That was the sublime. And Walden 2.
Walden 2?
Remember B.F. Skinner?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this guy, he was a guru on campus. I mean, he was, I don't know if there was a more influential person on American college campuses in the late 1960s than B.F. Skinner. And now he's a footnote in history. I mean, he's come and gone.
Yeah.
But de Tocqueville, I mean, reading de Tocqueville was wonderful.
Oh, that's right. You know, there's a great new translation of Tocqueville out by Harvey Mansfield, who's a Harvard professor and a great light, a beacon of wisdom in higher education today, who believes that the principles of de Tocqueville still should illuminate the way that we understand ourselves as Americans. But, you know, when you talk about, you know, comparing de Tocqueville with B.F. Skinner, that's really no better illustration of the point that one of the things that I've found in my latest research on happiness. If we want to buy happiness, the way that we buy it is with our values. You know, this is the currency with which we do most things in our lives, the currency with which we raise our kids, with which we function in society, with which we are successful or failures, is the currency of our values. And what you find is that what our parents and grandparents and clergy teach us is so close to the truth, that the principles that de Tocqueville found about America are so uncannily close to the truth in the postmodern stuff. The B.F. Skinner wisdom that dominated the 1960s, that tried to reorder fundamentally American society, is so far from being accurate that really it truly leads to misery. And that's an empirical observation. That's something that comes from data. That's not my own personal beliefs at all.
Well, just for those listeners who may be too young, you were blessed to be young enough that you didn't get exposed to B.F. Skinner. B.F. Skinner was a behavioral psychologist who basically believed that human beings were rats in a maze. And he actually wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, saying that freedom and dignity were outmoded concepts that human beings had to abandon in order to move forward in progress, and caused one of my heroes, Francis Schaeffer, to write a rebuttal called Back to Freedom and Dignity, which your two books do a lot to buttress Francis Schaeffer's argument against B.F. Skinner's.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's because what I've found is that this idea that what we need is to start over and to reorder all of our morals, that the traditional morals are wrong, is absolutely incorrect. Now, and incidentally, there is a belief sometimes that having strong moral codes and precepts, that living in a way that respects traditional values, somehow that does violence to freedom, is absolutely wrong as well. Let me tell you about something that I found that really shocked me in the happiness book, but it helped me understand morality and freedom in an entirely different new way. I was doing work in this latest happiness book to figure out the relationship between American liberty and freedom. And I thought to myself, either I'm going to find that a greater sense of liberty is going to make you happy in every regard, or I'm going to find that greater sense of liberty is going to be accompanied by insecurity and make you less happy. And that's the view of a lot of people who don't believe that free markets are good. They think that they're too insecure and capitalism is a bad idea, that free religion is a problem because what it does is it makes religion dominate people's lives and it cuts down their ability to make their own decisions. But other people will say, no, more freedom is better. Well, here's what we find, and it's a complicated truth, but I think your listeners might appreciate it. You find that economic liberty, religious freedom, freedoms that are related to the concepts of political, religious, and economic life always bring more happiness. But there's one area in which greater freedom makes us less happy, and that's in the area of morality. People who believe that there are no constraints on their moral actions, people who believe that they can do anything they want morally, are the unhappiest Americans. So what does this mean? And what it means is not that the government should govern every one of our freedoms and take away our ability to drink alcohol and do types of things that can be ruinous for us. On the contrary, the happiest people are those who constrain their own moral freedoms by exercising their religious freedoms. People who believe through their religious lives that there are limits on what they can do, and therefore they impose personally the types of limits that give them the most fulfilling existence.
Now, I'm guessing here, but my guess is that you have had a firestorm of criticism blasted at you for writing these two books. I mean, you know, my guess is you're going to be like my friend from college days, my classmate, John Stossel, who said, you know, when he began to investigate the fact that there were innate differences between the sexes, that he had this withering firestorm turned on him by the radical feminists who said, you shouldn't even be investigating this, and if it's true, you shouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah, it's not easy all the time, but I have to say it's a privilege to be able to talk about things that are not generally investigated and to say things that are not common if I believe they honestly are true. You know, it's a stewardship is a great responsibility and a wonderful privilege. When we are endowed with resources, whether it be money or time or love or energy or affection or leadership, we know that it is our duty to be good stewards of those particular gifts. If we don't, we're no better than the people who squander their talents biblically. Such is the case when I'm endowed with data, in my view. I mean, it sounds like a kind of a crazy idea, but if I'm given the ability to look at real patterns in the evidence about what's really going on, that is a stewardship responsibility. Mm-hmm. To talk about the truth and to be able to do so is such a great source of joy. And what that means is that my stewardship responsibility is not just an intellectual one. I have a responsibility to be nice about it, to be respectful about it, and to try to engage other people in a way that will exemplify what I think the truth of my teaching should be. If I'm not a nice person about it, I'll drive people further away. They'll say, well, he's just a crank. But if I can actually engage people to say, well, what about that research about charity and happiness that says that traditional values are the way to go? The guy who talks about it actually seems like a reasonable person. Now, that's a wonderful responsibility, mm-hmm. a great privilege.
Well, good. I appreciate that very much. And I'm very grateful that you did this research and that you have shared it in more than just peer-reviewed journals. You know, I often make the contrast between Walter Rauschenbusch and Charles Sheldon. You know, Rauschenbusch had a huge impact for a little while, but nobody's reading his books anymore. They're still reading in his steps because he went after changing the culture. And I'd say you're more of a Sheldon than a Rauschenbusch, and I mean that as a compliment.
No, I appreciate that. It's, you know, trying to change in some small way the way people think toward greater accuracy. That's something worth doing.
As I said, I have dubbed you Dr. Brooks Arthur the Myth Slayer, and one of the myths that you slay is the myth that the idea that compassionate conservatism is an oxymoron.
Yeah, that's true. It's one of the things that you find, for example, is that conservative-headed households, or the head of the household is a conservative or very conservative political person, that these households give, on average, 30% more of their income to charity each year than liberal or very liberal households, despite earning 9% less money. But that together suggests that we simply can't call, you know, conservatives hard-hearted anymore. Not to mention, it goes beyond, you know, money, especially money given to houses of worship. If conservatives, or I should say, if liberals and moderates started giving blood in America the way conservatives already do, the blood supply in America would jump by 45% overnight. Now, that's real lives saved that we're talking about here, and so we're not just talking about giving money to the local Baptist church. We're talking about doing something that goes beyond faith-based giving. although I must say for most Americans, giving is an entirely faith-based effort no matter where they give it. And so under those circumstances, the myth of the idea that compassion conservatism is a myth is itself a myth.
One of the things I found surprising about your book is that the extent to which people who identify themselves as conservative and even religious conservatives give not just to their churches, but they give more to everything, and not just, as you've pointed out, of their money and of their literal blood, but of their time as well.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the biggest reason that you find that conservatives in America give more than liberals, by far the biggest reason is faith. Conservative religious folks, particularly conservative Christians, outnumber religious liberals by 4-1 in America today. And that disparity is increasing, because one of the things that you find is that political liberals are less and less likely to practice a religion every year. I mean, the percentage has gone down significantly since the early 1970s, whereas the percentage of conservatives that are practicing the religion has increased by 50% over the same period, which is to say conservative folks are getting more religious and liberal folks are getting less religious. Religion is the biggest factor in charitable giving. It's one of the biggest factors in life satisfaction, optimism, and happiness as well. And that's the reason that you find some of these patterns, that conservatives give more than liberals, that conservatives are literally twice as likely to say they're very happy people as are liberals. A lot of it comes down to faith. Now, some of your listeners, if they're religious liberals, they're going to say, yeah, that's right. This is one of the problems with being a political liberal, is because it's getting harder and harder to be a religious person. My own brother is a liberal evangelical, and he says it's tough. You know, it's tough because the people with whom you feel comfortable politically are less and less likely to be respectful of your religious views. This actually, according to the data, is driving something like 200,000 adult Americans every year away from their politics because of their faith. And that poses a big problem for the American left, and one that I think is totally needless. We need political debate, but we also need respect for religious views.
Well, and of course, that's a huge debate going on right now within the Democratic Party. You have Obama really trying to reach out to religious folk, and in doing so, there are a lot of people in his own party who are very, very unhappy and very uncomfortable with his religious talk.
That's right. The overwhelming secularism, particularly among movement liberals, people who are trying to change the movement, trying to, you know, the ones who would demonstrate in the streets and come out to rallies. These are the people who call themselves extremely liberal, for example. Uh-huh. And this is by far the least religious group in America today, and quickly getting less and less religious. It doesn't take very much among people in this group to hear open insults about the very idea of faith. Now, there are few things that are closer to a founding principle, the gestalt of America, if you will, than the idea that faith is important. The amazing thing when you look at data on the subject is that the actual religion doesn't matter that much. If people have an abiding faith in a nutritious religion, be it Southern Baptist or Roman Catholic, an Orthodox Jew, it doesn't matter. It turns out that that principle of believing in the Supreme Being and or living according to that principle is so nutritious for charity, for optimism, for principles of mental health, for happiness, for all the things that we're talking about here, that, I mean, it was clearly understood by the Founding Fathers that getting away from it is a very dangerous concept.
Dr. Brooks, we've got a lot to talk about, and we're just not anywhere near through exploring this subject. So could you come back and be with us again tomorrow?
I'd be delighted to do that.
You're listening to For Faith and Family with Dr. Richard Land. I'm Harold Harper. Our special guest today has been Dr. Arthur Brooks. He's written two books, Who Really Cares and Gross National Happiness. And these books basically delve into how Americans give and what makes them happy. They provide confirmation that faith, family, and giving are important keys to our well-being. Both books are available at our website at faithandfamily.com. Also, if you missed a portion of today's broadcast or you won't be able to be with us tomorrow, I want to encourage you to stop by our website and get a copy of the entire program or listen online. You can do so when you go to our website at faithandfamily.com. For Faith and Family Radio is produced in Nashville, Tennessee by the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. For more information about our guests and past programs, please visit our website at faithandfamily.com. Our producer for today's broadcast is Amber Chesser. Our executive producer is Matt Hawkins. I'm Harold Harper, and I hope you'll join us again next time for Faith and Family with Dr. Richard Land. Merry Christmas from all of us here at For Faith and Family. To celebrate this festive season, we'd like to revisit a few of our favorite programs from 2008. So relax and enjoy as we hear some powerful messages from our guests this week. Also, be sure to tune in next Monday and Tuesday as we air a special Christmas program with Dr. Tom Eliff. He's going to tell us a compelling Christmas story he calls The Red Feather. Hello and welcome to another edition of For Faith and Family with Dr. Richard Land. I'm Harold Harper, and today we welcome back for a second day Dr. Arthur Brooks. He was with us yesterday to discuss how people's values and worldview affect their charitable giving. And today we're going to see how that affects our happiness as well. Dr. Brooks is a professor of public administration at the Syracuse University. He's also the author of two books, Who Really Cares? And Gross National Happiness. Let's join Dr. Land as he welcomes our guest.
This is Dr. Richard Land, and you're listening to For Faith and Family. We want to welcome you back to our second program as we're interviewing Dr. Arthur Brooks, the author of Who Really Cares? And Gross National Happiness. Now, Dr. Brooks, I think it's important, because of the things you say, that we hear a little bit about your academic background and the fact that you are a true blue tenured professor of public administration at Syracuse's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Now tell us how you get to be that.
Well, like all other academics in America, I went through graduate school and got my PhD. I looked for a position in traditional academia where I would be able to do research, to do my teaching. I'm a behavioral economist. I do work on how the economy actually affects people's behavior and how their behavior affects the economy. And what I hoped to be able to do was to, in a regular university position, was to uncover some of the truths that might illuminate why we do what we do and what motivates us to be who we are.
Well, I appreciate that, and the fact that you've done this and shared it not just with the peer review journals, but that you've written these two very informative, I think very encouraging, and very helpful books. Now, one of the things that I found fascinating in the book Gross National Happiness is you say that conservatives are more likely to be married and more likely to go to religious services on a weekly basis, and they're more likely to have children and more of them than liberals. Talk to us about that.
Traditional family life is something that is increasingly associated with the political right in America. This is a terrible, terrible shame, in my view, but it is the truth. And part of it has to do with the fact that conservatives typically start their families earlier. They are more likely to live outside of major cities. They're more likely to have grown up under traditional circumstances. But the end result is exactly that you know, two-thirds of conservative adults are married. Only one-third of liberal adults are married. That conservatives are far more likely to have kids. Conservatives have 40% more children on average than liberals do. Conservative religious people have 78% more kids on average than secular liberals do. And there are lots of reasons for that. But the point of the matter is, if you know secular liberals don't like it, well then they sort of need to get busy.
Well, you know, we've actually got a website. A web page at our website on all of the statistics that show this, and it's not just true in the United States. It's true in France and other places that people who are conservative are more likely to be married and have more children and raise them to be conservative, and that there is this, as you point out, this huge fertility gap, and that it's beginning to affect policy. For instance, the younger you are in America, the more pro-life you are.
Right.
And the reason is that you're far more likely to have been born into a pro-life family and to have been raised to be pro-life, because pro-lifers have a lot more children than people who are pro-choice do, and they raise them to be pro-life.
Yeah, that's right. That will increasingly be the case. I mean, I wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal last year that showed the fact that Ohio, had it not been for the fertility gap between left and right today, would not even be a swing state,
mm-hmm.
not even close.
Mm-hmm.
It would be absolutely a Democrat overwhelming you know, hegemonic victory every mm-hmm. single time. It would be, they wouldn't even have to campaign there. But the fact is that, or since the early 1970s, that conservatives have had more and more kids, and religious conservatives in particular have more and more kids. The gap with them and the left has been growing such that states are starting to become swing states. Now, that doesn't mean that the Republicans are always going to win, but they are more competitive than they would have been in a lot more states. This is a blessing or a curse. It might mean that they just naturally have been able to plug into certain demographics and not work as hard. Some people believe that the Republicans are starting to take conservative Christians utterly for granted because they realize that there's no other place that these folks can go. And the minute the Republicans do that, well, we all know what happens. It's not good things happen.
And in fact, most of these people that are voting Republican don't consider themselves Republicans. They're voting on social issues. They're voting on cultural issues. And, you know, I was asked to explain to some German leaders who had come over to the U.S. about the involvement of evangelicals and Catholic conservatives in the political process. And I pointed out that, you know, when I was growing up, whether you were a Republican or a Democrat was really more a function of the region of the country you lived in and your economic status. And that now, except for the very, very poor, and except for the very, very rich, economic status is a very poor indicator of whether you vote Republican or whether you vote Democrat. That things like, if you're a single woman, 62% of single or divorced women voted for John Kerry. 59% of married women voted for George Bush.
Right.
If you went to religious services, and as you've pointed out before, it doesn't matter what kind of religious services. If you went to religious services more than once a week, you voted for George Bush 2-1.
Right.
If you never or seldom went to religious services, you voted 3-1 for John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a picture beginning to emerge that has much less to do with economics and much more to do with worldview issues. And you see this as well when it comes to your data in terms of giving, don't you?
Sure. I see this in terms of happiness as well. In the even later research, you find that the people who hold traditional views and live in traditional lifestyles are fundamentally happier people. Religious people are twice as likely to say they're very happy as secular people in totally anonymous surveys. Conservatives themselves are about twice as likely to say they're very happy people. And you put religion and politics together, and the happiness gap absolutely explodes. So the question that remains then is, what's going on in liberal politics such that they're able to vacuum up so many people who are unhappy? This is something that has, you know, obviously gotten me a lot of arguments from my colleagues and friends who are overwhelmingly politically liberal. Is when I say things like this, that, you know, the liberal political establishment today relies on a lot of forces that remind people that they're not as happy as they could be. When you listen to a lot of liberal politicians today, they are reminding their voters that they are victims, that they don't have control, that they are not inherently problem solvers, and so a lot of folks are taking that to heart. But those who believe that the American system provides mobility and opportunity for themselves, for their kids, and for other people are the folks that are the happiest Americans, and these are the folks that are disproportionately on the religious, political right today. There should be a lesson in that for folks that believe that the left wing has the right political message. And I'm not going to treat that disrespectfully. I mean, reasonable people disagree about politics. But the idea that the people who are the most miserable are the natural political constituency, that's a big problem.
I found a lot in your book that in Gross National Happiness that I found encouraging, of course, as someone who's a religious conservative. But you point out that your data are quite clear that conservatives are more optimistic about the future in general and their own future. And the future of their country. They have a fundamentally more optimistic attitude about the country, don't they?
They do. There's a sunnier worldview on the right today, which is really interesting because if you talk to a lot of folks on the left, they think that everybody on the right's unhappy and angry. You know, every time Republicans win some sort of major victory, they say, oh, it's because of the so-called angry young male voter or something. You know, they'll make some explanation that has to do with reaction or anger or resentment against, you know, the way things are going in the modern world. But in point of fact, what you find is it's just usually regular folks who believe that things are going okay, notwithstanding the fact that they don't like the government and they don't trust politicians and they don't even like how the economy is going, they're pretty optimistic about the way our country is structured. These people are sort of values-based voters, and they're disproportionately captured by the political right. Now, the Republican Party has done a pretty good job messing this up. The Republican Party, by, you know, redistributing a lot of income, doing really profligate spending, and being involved in a number of corruption scandals, has done a pretty good impression of, you know, impressing on folks that the Republicans and Democrats are no different.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, is what's messing up these elections. I mean, the fact, for the Republicans at least, either good or bad news, depending on your point of view, that, I mean, the best explanation for why Republicans are losing is because they have not been, you know, have not acted according to values, have not acted according to the governing conservative values that got them elected in the first place. Sadly, a lot of Republican politicians still haven't learned this lesson.
Well, that's right. I visit Washington all the time, and if anything, you're being kind.
Thank you.
You are underplaying the truth of what you were saying. There's no question about that. Now, Dr. Brooks, one of the things that I wanted to ask you when I read this book, the Gross National Happiness book, is, okay, liberals are better off economically than conservatives. Why?
Well, there are sort of two reasons. The people who are doing very, very poorly are frequently political liberals. Disproportionately, the non-working poor mm-hmm. associate with the political left in this country. But a lot of the very, very rich entrepreneurs in this country, despite their lineage, are pretty liberal as well. It's a different kind of left-wing politics than that which we associate with sort of the populist left. I mean, they believe in free enterprise as much as the next guy, but they're very socially liberal, is what we find.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not that's misguided or not, once again, that depends on the point of view, but that's driving a lot of, you know, the very rich folks on the left is driving some of these salary numbers. The other thing that we find, however, is that everybody's just been getting better off. The Democrats like to tell anybody who will listen that inequality is the overriding characteristic in American life, that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. That's completely false, according to the data. The rich are getting richer, but only faster than the poor are getting richer. Every income not every person, incidentally. Some folks have done worse, and I want to make that clear. But every income group in American society over the past 35 years is doing significantly better in purchasing power. You know, we're turning into a richer country. We're turning into more of a prosperous nation, as it turns out. And when we do that, a lot of the income disparities are going to flip between the parties, and a lot of the traditional income differences are going to disappear.
You talk about happiness predictors, and the first one is faith. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, what we find is just in the data that people who practice a religion are happier than those who don't practice a religion. But once again, it's the actual religion tends to drop out. The two religious groups that appear happiest in the data are evangelical Christians and Orthodox Jews, who are at the very top of the happiness heap. Below them are Roman Catholics, like me, but all of the religious groups are way, way, way above secularists.
Well, you know, thinking about very traditional and practicing Catholics, I was reminded of the late, great William F. Buckley, Jr., who had a tremendous influence on me. He was a very serious Catholic, and one of the stories that was told at his memorial service that I just love is he was being interviewed by Playboy magazine, and this was back when Hefner himself was doing the interviewing. And so he was, at the end of the interview, Hefner asked him, he said, "Now, do you have one last word for, a parting word for our readers?" And Buckley said, "Yes, I know that my Redeemer lives." And they published it. They published it. So even in Playboy magazine, he gave a witness for his faith. Isn't that great?
It's a wonderful thing.
I mean, it's so Buckley. I mean, it's so Buckley.
There's a lesson for that in there for us, I believe, as people who take our faith seriously but are trying to be current in public policy in America today. We can live in the modern world. We can live in the world of modern media, and we can walk among people that have postmodern values, and we can do it without hostility. We can do it with love, and we can do it with good humor. I talk about, you and I have a mutual friend in Michael Medved.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, And, you know, Michael's a great example. He's a film critic, but he's a serious Orthodox Jew. He takes his faith as seriously as anybody I know. He can stay in the modern world. He can stay up to speed with the best of them. And he's a witness for the fact that there's nothing, you don't have to go live in a cave. You don't have to reject all of the parts of the modern world. On the contrary, real stewardship means engaging the modern world in a way that has this kind of humor and goodness about it, like Bill Buckley.
Yeah. And you know, Michael, and you say Michael's a great witness. He is the only person who is Jewish that I've ever met who actually shared his faith with me. And I shared my faith with him. And we did so cordially, we did so straightforwardly, and we agreed that we were both going to continue in our own faith and wish the other one well, and then we proceeded, you know, to do the things that we were there to do together. The idea that you cannot deal with issues and share your faith and come to differing conclusions and still do so civilly. I mean, it seems to me that the American proposition is that we believe in principled pluralism, and that is that we respect people's right to their views, and we understand that people are going to have different views, and we agree to share our views with each other without seeking to intimidate or to silence the other.
Right. I think I completely agree with that, and I think that furthermore we have a tendency to get a siege mentality among people who are deeply religious in America today. We have a tendency to view secular modern life as one that's actually trying to take away our liberties. And I understand the attacks on religious life in this country, but I think it's worth keeping in mind what life is like in other countries. You know, we take for granted the fact that we can go to church on Sunday or we can go to the synagogue on Saturday morning and, you know, no cops are going to show up and burn down the house of worship and beat us up. You know, we have incredible pluralism in this country that we have to celebrate and respect, and that, I think, brings real humility when we're talking to people who don't agree with us. And if we think that our values are fundamentally important, I think that we can emphasize those values and bring people over to our point of view, but not necessarily through combat. I mean, it's hard to save souls when you're telling people how evil they are.
Well, that's right. And, you know, in fact, I took part in a documentary, mm-hmm. and it was done by two Mormon documentary makers who are very, very good. In fact, the documentary is going to be in commercial release in the fall. And in that, an African American, actually evangelical, says, you know, I've noticed that there are very few people who are willing to take a tract from you when you're yelling at them, which, you know, is really the point you were making. You know, when you're yelling at people and when you're attacking people, they're not very likely to respond to what you have to say in a positive way.
There's one more point about the separation of church and state that I think it's worth keeping in mind for people who take their faith very seriously and who believe that the expression of faith is a fundamentally important thing in American life. When you look at the economics of faith, one of the things that you find is that a competitive market for souls is one of the biggest reasons that America continues to be an incredibly religious country, fundamentally more religious than any other developed country. The deal is that when nobody is forcing a particular religion down our throats, we are much, much more likely to come to the truth and reality of our Redeemer. That's just a fact on the ground. And there's no better argument for the continued basic secular society that's respectful of religion than that fact, that we actually need people to be able to worship in the way that expresses their views, that expresses their soul in the absolute best way. And America has come across this marvelous formula for doing it.
Well, it has. And, you know, this what another thing that would buttress that is that Baylor study that was just released last year about religion in America that shows that something like 40% of adult Americans have changed their faith.
That's right.
Now, that means that they are not just, you know, what was it Jaroslav Pelikan said, the Yale theologian, he said that traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. Tradition is the living faith of the dead.
I love that.
Isn't that great?
That's profound.
It is profound. And so the fact that we do have this freedom, and we do have this competitive market where people are free to search for a religious experience and a religious tradition that is meaningful to them, not just the one they may have inherited or the one they may have come across in their youth, means that that people are free to follow a faith that makes a difference in their lives. And that's one reason why faith is so vibrant in this country.
True. And, you know, we're making more and more progress in faith communities for understanding the varieties of religious experience better. I mean, the fact that you and our friend Michael Medved have a respectful, you know, mutually respectful stance on each other's faith, in a way where he treasures your faith as much as you treasure his, is this wonderful aspect of the ecumenical modern American faith tradition. That the threat to that, of course, is this idea that you know, stamping out all expressions of religion is the appropriate thing to do, that secularism is the inevitable end in modern life. Quite false, according to the data, and really a recipe for misery.
Well, that's absolutely right. And now we're almost out of time, and I want to get to a huge myth that is, I think, doing untold damage to millions of our fellow citizens, and I want you to slay the myth for us.
Right.
This is the myth that arose and as part of the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s, that marriage is somehow confining for women, and that marriage detracts from women's happiness. And a lot of young women have bought into this myth and have not been as open to marriage as their mothers or their grandmothers have been. And your book shows that being married and having a family is one of the most important paths to happiness.
True, and there are a couple of reasons for it. But first, the data. Women in general are happier than men. Single women are a little bit happier than single men. Married women are a lot happier than married men. The only group where men are happier than women is divorced men. Divorced men are happier than divorced women, and a big part of that has to do with the fact that divorced women typically have to be single parents, which is a highly, highly stressful situation. But just in general, you find that women are so happy, particularly in the context of traditional family life, because they're less likely to fall prey to the tyranny of materialism. Men, in point of fact, people who are the happiest in America today are the people who feel that they're successful in creating value for others. The problem is one of the easiest ways to measure success is in terms of money. And the big mistake that men often make is only following the money, which is only a measure of the thing that we really care about, which is success in creating value for others. When people say the only way for women to be fulfilled is to go out into market work just like men, I mean, good for women who want to do market work. And I think that people should have the freedom to do what they want. But
absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, women ought to be free to do whatever they feel will make them happy. But the reality is that the way feminism has worked out in this country is sort of sad, because basically we've said, okay, it's okay for women to do all the destructive, all the self-destructive and negative things that men do. And instead of raising the standard for men, we've lowered the standard for women, so now they're falling prey to diseases that have been associated with men.
And for happiness, that disease is materialism. Women can be very, very happy, as can men, in traditional market work. The key is remembering that it's success and not money that's at the heart of it.
Dr. Brooks, before we let you go, I know that our listeners will want to know the answer to this question. How can we pray for you?
I think that we can pray that we all look for the truth in the patterns in life around us, and that when we find the truth, we'll always use it primarily for the glory of God and for the good of others, and not simply for the good of ourselves.
Well, amen to that. And thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule to share with us and to visit with us here at For Faith and Family.
Thank you, Richard. What a privilege it's been to be with you.
You're listening to For Faith and Family with Dr. Richard Land. I'm Harold Harper. Our special guest today has been Dr. Arthur Brooks. He has written two books, Who Really Cares and Gross National Happiness, and they delve into how much Americans give and what makes them happy. Both books confirm that faith, family, and giving are important keys to our well-being. Both books are also available at our website at faithandfamily.com. If you missed a portion of today's program or you weren't able to join us yesterday, I want to encourage you to stop by our website and get a copy of the entire program or listen online. You can do so when you go to our website at faithandfamily.com. For Faith and Family Radio is produced in Nashville, Tennessee by the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. For more information about our guest and past programs, please visit our website at faithandfamily.com. Our producer for today's broadcast is Amber Chesser. Our executive producer is Matt Hawkins. I'm Harold Harper, and I hope you'll join us again next time for Faith and Family with Dr. Richard Land.